You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Well, it's been a pretty uneventful few days around the world, it seems, including the fact that our last episode was pulled from YouTube by YouTube due to inappropriate content, and the only thing I suspect it could have been is in regards to the name of a hotel that myself and Mike were discussing. So I had to remove all mention of the said hotel before YouTube would allow the episode to return, edited, after a few days. They've still not told me if that's the reason. They've just ignored me, which apparently seems to be the norm. But anyway, enough of me wittering on. It's funny now looking back, but I was a little annoyed, to say the least. Oh well. Anyway, this week sees the return of the ever-popular Paul Sinclair to discuss his fantastic new book, Night People, that he released over the summer. Night People is a bit of a departure from Paul's previous work and is a brutally honest account of a life touched by some deeply disturbing incidents. We cover several of these incidents, Paul's encounters with the infamous Reverend Tom Willis, the haunted trawler known as the Pickering, and Paul's latest investigation, the documentary entitled The Dark Forest Project, and the subject matter may surprise you. I've got to know Paul quite well outside of the show, so it's always good to bring one of our chats to you guys, and I hope you enjoy where we go with it. Don't forget, you can support the show by signing up to Patreon for $4 a month. Our latest episode with Richard Freeman, entitled Death by Cryptid, should be on there in the next couple of days. So, if you want to hear me and Richard discuss some rather gruesome tales of mysterious murders by cryptids across the world, then Patreon's the place to find it. You can find us under Mysteries and Monsters, or you can click the show notes and find out the link from there. As always, you can also support the show by finding our merchandise through Redbubble, and the link will be in this week's show notes as usual. We're across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and most of the time we'll be on YouTube, and you can subscribe to our channel just in case we get banned before we do anything else. Who knows? The way things are going, anything's possible this side of Christmas. As always, the artwork for this week's show has been done by Dean Bestel. The show has been produced by Brennan Storr from the marvellous Ghost Story Guys. And as always, Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's join Paul Sinclair for another brilliant conversation on a variety of weird and wonderful subjects. This week on Mysteries and Monsters, it's a warm welcome back to one of my most popular guests, Paul Sinclair. With his new book, The Night People, released over the summer, and work on a new documentary, The Dark Forest Project, Paul has continued his investigations into the high strangeness occurring in East Yorkshire. Paul, welcome back to the show. How are we?
All good so far. Thank you very much, Paul. And as always, pleasure to be back talking to you and sharing a few ideas, stories and other bits that you've managed to throw at me during the course of this conversation, Paul.
Well, I'll try my best, my friend.
We'll start wherever you like.
The Night People, a bit of a departure from what people may have expected after your work in the Truth Proof books, Paul. I have to say I found it brutally honest, the way that you've reflected upon your life and your experiences. You've not shied away from anything, Paul.
That's true. You know, I've said this before, I did consider not publishing it right up till last, to be honest with you, and I even exchanged a few emails with Whitley Strieber about whether I should things, because, you know, he's, I don't mean he's written a book similar, but he's written a book, Communion, and that sort of bears his soul about the things that have happened to him, and he's had a mixed response over the years from it, but in end I've done it. I'm glad I did. I know it's going to, eventually there's going to be some kind of negative feedback, but so far it's been quite positive. And yeah, it was hard to write in places, but I think now at 57 years old, some of them things that you'd have been embarrassed about saying, I don't know, maybe in your late teens, early 20s, that's gone. It doesn't matter. It's almost like looking at somebody else when writing about it. You know it's you, but it's almost like looking at somebody else than that little boy at 4 years old who were first having these experiences. And even when I moved up here almost 30 years ago, you know, that person, the memories are still there, but I'm a different person today to what I was then. I think we all sort of grow and change for better and for worse in some respects, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be brutally honest myself, Paul, I wasn't a particularly nice person in my late teens. I was a bit of a tearaway, you know? I was your archetypal out of control, you know, rebel without a cause.
Disappointing question then, because you'd probably look back at that and think, oh, what, that young man? Do you know what I mean? Because that's not what I am now.
Yeah. Now, very true, very true. So it was. I found it quite quite emotional reading about your early life and your experiences, Paul. I think for a lot of us who grew up in that era, because I'm not that far behind you age-wise, and obviously I grew up on the other side of Barnsley to you. So there was a lot of parallels that I could look at about how the family dynamic was and how people dealt with issues and how we dealt with personal situations. So I thought it was a very, very brave book, Paul, and all credit to you that you've felt strong enough, I think, to be able to let it out.
Well, thank you. And I didn't just want to write about my own experiences. I actually did set about painting a picture of what life was like back in the 1960s and 70s. And I hope I've got it. I hope I've done that, because I think probably in some respects they were, although people weren't as affluent, I mean, with the say that things are hard now, but everybody seems to have a massive TV stuck to the wall and drive around in decent cars, and that weren't the case then. Obviously those items weren't invented in that time, but what I'm meaning is we didn't seem to have as much money anyway, but everybody coped, everybody managed.
Yeah.
And I don't think it were a bad time to be alive. I mean, apart from these incidents that I've written about, but there you go.
It is interesting as well, because obviously this is something that seems to have been running, as far as you're aware, since you were a small boy, Paul. And obviously, the key sort of catalyst, regardless of your personal experiences, seems to have been that part where your father wakes you up to show you that strange light in the sky when I think you think it's about 66, 67.
I think it's got to be. It were outside at cooling towers of the Mexborough Power Station, probably three quarters at way up, and but above the rooftops of Mexborough, and to me it was just a line of a string of lights, and you could see rooftops. It must have been a bright night, because you could see the rooftops, but this wasn't the moon that we were looking at. And it was unusual in itself that he woke me up, because as I think I painted my dad in book as quite a stern kind of man, and he dished out punishment, and there's no denying that. It's not, I'm not doing him a disservice. I suppose it sounds like I am, but I'm only telling the truth. But for him to wake me up, there must have been something highly unusual for me to look at, and we watched this sphere of light, I think we've called it the moon on the rooftops, or the moon sphere, and it travelled the full length of Mexborough, literally. And I think it probably got halfway, going on for three quarters of the way, and he just left me watching it. And I was watching it through a pair of high-powered binoculars, high-powered for the day. They were ex-naval binoculars, and this thing was vibrant. It were turning, and it looked more lemon, or a lemon white colour. It were quite a wonderful thing to see. But after, and obviously I didn't think, I've seen a UFO, and I think my dad remarked it were a weather balloon.
Yeah.
because that's the staple explanation. And the point in question, my dad had fell for it. Anything that was seen in sky, weather balloon. Strange how weather balloons aren't used as an explanation now for spheres of light seen in sky. And we've moved on throughout the decades to different staple explanations. But why aren't the other explanations being used? Obviously, because in a lot of cases, it's been proved that it's a ridiculous explanation. Some of these things are the real deal. Where they come from, I don't know, Paul, but some of them are of true unknown origin.
Absolutely. I think some of them have become quite a humorous response these days, because obviously the most famous of these daft explanations is obviously swamp gas, Paul, which is what made Hynek go from a skeptic to a believer, because he was sick to death of trotting out the US government's excuse for any kind of unusual sighting. And he said, well, it simply cannot be swamp gas. And it was at that point that he just thought, there's a lot more to this than meets the eye, and I'm not prepared to play along with it anymore.
Yeah, and obviously he wasn't deceiver, but he was employed. His original role was to downplay the UFO aspect of it, and we've got and they deemed him intelligent enough and qualified enough to be a spokesman for that role, and he turned his back on it and became a proponent to sort of advance the word of the true UFO and the true sighting. You know, there is some merit to some of these sightings. We're not going to say all of them, but there is to some of them, and fair play to such a man like that.
Absolutely. You know, his education and his knowledge just speaks volumes, and for him to have flipped as broadly as he did, Paul, I think he clearly realised that there was a lot more to this, and he needed to be on the right side, I suspect, at that point, because I think he was sick to death of making, because the standard situation back in those days was to make people look stupid more than anything.
Yeah. Well, that's still attached. I wouldn't say with governments of the world, I don't think we hear as much opinion from them now, but it's still there, isn't it? It's still there with vast majority of public, or a lot of them. You know, somebody says they've seen something, and it's just a round of chuckles and a round, and sly comments. And then in between them all, them that are throwing sly comments out and chuckles will actually say, "Well, actually, I did see something unusual," you know. But I've no idea what it was, and they just pass it off. I can't get all my head round that kind of mindset when you've seen something that's totally off the wall, and then you're quite willing to just pass it off as, well, I don't know, it could have been anything. I mean, that's, I don't know, you know. I'm rambling a little bit there, Anna, but that's the way I do it.
Well, it is, and it's interesting as well, Paul, because obviously throughout all your work, your Truth Proof books, and you mentioned a situation in Night People as well, you've interviewed people and spoken to witnesses and had friends who have seen strange things, who within days have completely either changed their opinion or basically talked themselves out of what they thought they saw.
Without a doubt. I mean, jumping to 2002 and the sighting Sledmere that I had with Shorty, Chris Short, and that was at Sledmere, and we observed this object. We stood outside the van, pulled up and watched it. Right again, the old fire station at Sledmere, if anybody's familiar with these locations. And it's a huge glowing white tube on a bright sunny day. It were rounded at each end. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a cloud. I don't mean a structured craft. That'd be stupid. But, I went with stupid, but it wasn't a structured craft. Mm-hmm. But it was solid white and it was pulsing. We could feel it pulsing. Mm-hmm. We couldn't hear it. We could feel it. And Shorty's looking at me and looking at this and saying, is it one of them UFO thingies? I can hear him saying it now. And I'm saying, don't say you've not seen this tomorrow when you get to work, Shorty, because, you know, you can't deny it. Because I've got, obviously, people knew I'd got this interest back then, and he'd not got no interest whatsoever in any of this. So for him to be stood with me, you know, we were work colleagues anyway, so we worked together for about 4 or 5 years. And anyway, the following day at work, he couldn't stop talking about it, and I couldn't. You know, we were really interested. A few days passed, and he went quieter, and I don't know, it's no good me saying 2 weeks passed, but a period of time passed, and it was, oh yeah, we did see something, but I don't know. That's what you got. And I don't think I spoke to him for 3 or 4 years now. And if I mentioned it, it'd be, oh, yeah, we did see something, but I don't know. But so I don't know what occurs for somebody to do a full 360. I think it might be that they can't handle the fact that when they mention it, they're the butt of people's jokes. It could be as simple as that in some instances. Mm. You know, I mean, we put an advert in. I contacted the local paper after the Sledmere sighting, and a couple wrote in the following week, and they'd seen it as well. Mm. You know, it's really, really interesting the way people react to seeing these things. You know, to me, if you are seeing something like that, I mean, I don't mean let's get blown away by a satellite flying through the sky and let's tell everybody we've seen a spaceship, because I do realise there are people that see satellites or see Chinese lanterns. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case with the vast majority of these sightings. I've heard people say the lights that we've observed over the sea off Bempton, Flamborough and Speighton and around Scarborough are Chinese lanterns. These at sea, you know, I've said before, from the cliffs to the horizon, you've got over 20 miles, 22 miles. These things are miles out at sea. Hmm. They're not floating in from land. They're just switching on from nowhere, punching out into bunches of three, fours and five, switching off and then appearing 20 miles down coast towards Filey or Scarborough. And believe it or not, people, you can see 20 miles down coast. You can see 45 miles away at Salt End and see the burn off of the gas and things, you know. So you've got fabulous views. And so they're not Chinese lanterns and they're not flares. You know, flares will drop, you know, from an aircraft, obviously, or fired from a boat.
Yeah.
But it lights the area around it up, and the light is so bright and sufficient that you'll see the smoke. Mm. No, there's nothing like that. I know we've sort of moved on a bit from what we were talking about, Paul, but sometimes the explanations given are more ridiculous than the actual explanation that the witness, the person qualified to say what he's seen, is describing.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite interesting, though. I mean, and it does tie up with the night people as well, Paul, because obviously one of the key aspects of your experiences throughout this is the injuries that you attained at various points of your life. And it's very interesting, because every time you go to the doctors, they are under the impression that you've been physically assaulted by a member of your family.
I think they thought my wife were doing it at one point. I think they thought Mary, somehow I were allowing Mary to, I don't know, burn holes into my arms and into my back. Mm. Obviously, her name were never mentioned, but she was closest person to me. Yeah. Point in question is the night that I woke up and sat at the edge of the bed, you know, the following morning, and Mary just said to me, "I don't believe it, Paul, you've got three holes in your back." Mm. And I knew what had happened that night, but when I went to the doctors and then went to the hospital, and there's the doctor at Bridlington Hospital saying, you know, "Mr. Sinclair, you couldn't have done these injuries yourself, and you can tell us." And, you know, and I, they know I'm lying, and I'm lying for a totally different reason to what they think.
Yeah.
They think I'm getting physically abused. They thought somebody had done this to me, some, you know, man or woman, beat my wife, but I'm lying because I don't tell them that I woke up in the night and saw these lights moving around my bedroom, and in between seeing the lights I saw the figures, and then another instance during that same sort of bout or that same incident, they stood outside at bed, and then you're being told that a bed spring's turning in your back by these beings, but they're not telling you verbally. You're getting this. It's hard to explain. You don't imagine that you're hearing the words, and it's not schizophrenia, people. You know, I'm just being told there's a bed spring turning in my back. Nothing to worry about. I'm on my back. There's no bed spring turning. The bed's not decrepit, but it feels like a brace and bit or a corkscrew going into my back, and it went deep in whatever it was, and the pain was just excruciating. And was I in bed? That's another question. Throughout all these experiences, Paul, you know, I know I've heard other people talk about their encounters, their abductions, should we say, and talked about being on a craft and all that. And I've just got no recollection of anything like that. But at that incident, when they left me with three holes in my back, I'm thinking, I were laid on my back. or at least I thought I was. My wife was at the side of me in bed. How could she have slept through it? How could they have done a procedure on my back if I'm laid in bed? I've got to have, everything's like a layer and a double layer of deceit. And they're just so clever. It's as, almost as though they can go inside your mind and pick through it, like we can pick files out of a computer. It really is. It's such a strange one, and it's an hard one for people to get their heads round, because I've got, apart from the scars, are my word.
Yeah.
I've got nothing else. I cannot prove anything that I'm saying. And once again, I've said this before, but we're a skeptic stroke debunker's dream scenario, because we can't prove a word we're saying. What we're saying sounds absolutely ridiculous. You know, to most ears, unless you've experienced it yourself, then you know it's not.
Yeah.
So it's a no-win situation. I mean, I did spend, oh God, so much time, I'll call it crafting words and turning situations, not to make it as believable as possible, but to make it as plausible, to make it as readable as I could for the listener. And I do that with truth proof books as well. So anybody who gives me an account, no matter how small, I try and put those people, if providing I believe they're genuine, I try and put those people over in the most favourable light I can. And do you know what I mean? And look for other information to pack around their sightings, to, you know, use, you know, other sightings, other unusual events, and that doesn't make their sighting real. It doesn't make it any more true. But if you can find other stuff to pack around these things, it shows, or it tells the reader, well, there were these other events going off at the same time. There's lots of paranormal activity happening at the same time. I did it with Cliff Lane when the mutilations were occurring, and I found lots of witnesses that were experiencing other unexplained events. And if you can find these people, Paul, and put them all together, it doesn't, once again, you've only got anecdotal evidence, but you've got a lot of it. Same with Dark Forest. I'm not going to go in with to place names and things like that, except that it's in the forests of North Yorkshire, and it spills out onto the coasts of East and North Yorkshire. But we've got witnesses going back nearly 20 years. Well, some further, but the principal ones, 20 years, 2 years, some to 2017, all singing from the same hymn sheet. None of them know each other. Well, apart from three that had an incident in the forest. And they were together. Then we've got another guy who was in the forest, highly qualified sort of man as regards the job he was doing, gamekeeper.
Yeah.
And they're all saying a very, very similar thing. And you think to yourself, anecdotal evidence, once again, one man's word, two or three men's word, you know, it's always better because we've got these other people. We've got three of them all corroborating, all saying the same thing. And we've only got the word. It's anecdotal, but there's more substance to it when we're in a tight location, a 30-mile radius of everywhere, and they're seeing similar things. I think it's fabulous. I mean, it gets me quite excited, to be honest, upbeat, that we're actually onto something when we actually start laying everything out about Dark Forest. And I know you want to talk about night people. When we actually start laying everything out about Dark Forest and the research that I've found packing around Dark Forest Project, and even to jump into Tony Dodd's research, and obviously crediting Tony, do you know, even jump into some think letters that we've got from the 1990s that substantiate what one of the witnesses is telling us, who has no idea who Tony Dodd was, and it becomes really interesting. I think we're producing something really special here.
Yeah, it certainly looks interesting and enticing, Paul. So
it's going to be, really. I mean, honestly, the information that's packing around it's brilliant. I'm sorry for saying it like that, but it really is.
Hey, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. It's very interesting as well when you look at the book in regards to how you've ended up in the place you are today, Paul, because do you think that these incidents led you into your interest, or do you think this was always going to happen regardless?
That's a good point. It were probably always going to happen. I don't mean like preordained as if it's something special. And obviously, if you've had these happenings, these occurrences at a young age, you're not really aware. You're not really familiar with what's happening, as in you don't know it's really unusual. At 4 years old, I didn't know that. And I didn't talk about it to anybody. As a child, just rarely. I don't think I did. I don't think I talked about it. So I didn't know if other boys and girls were experiencing similar things. And then as you get older, perhaps the difference is perhaps a lot of children do. And perhaps the only difference is that things don't happen to them when they get older. Because I could I only recall these little bits, these, I suppose, the strongest parts of the sort of scenarios. And I don't know whether I would have got involved in it as much if the things hadn't have happened during childhood. I mean, the things during childhood have carried on all the way through, so it's always been there. And then eventually the penny drops. I'd always, you know, anything about UFOs or sightings of strange lights that appeared in the papers, I was sort of on it and reading it, not researching it, but reading it. I think the research started about 2000, but the actual interest, the passion, had been there long before. But it were fear, I think. When we lived at Doncaster, you know, you'll know Edlington, won't you?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we lived at Sproutborough and we lived at Edlington. There, I sort of knew what were happening. I understood it as much as I could understand it, as much as anybody could understand the abductions. I knew what they were doing. I knew what it was, but I just didn't talk about it at that time. I sort of feared it. And I suppose if it were happening on a regularly now, I probably would be reluctant to talk about it. You know, things happen, but not with the same sort of ferocity, not waking up and finding holes in your body and being frightened to go to sleep because you don't know. And you're always, that's another thing, you're always going to be ready when it happens, but you're not. Yeah. No matter what some people may be, but I'm not. You know, some people talk about it being some kind of utopian dream where they sort of, I don't know, they're almost treading through a field full of flowers with these aliens, but or if that's what you want to call them. Yeah. But that wasn't the case for me. Mm. And I don't know whether they're dreaming or whether it's an actual scenario. It might be the same beings. They might have a total disregard for us as actual flesh and blood beings. It might be just an emotional reaction that they're wanting, and they probably get a better kick, a better positive emotional reaction out of some people than they do others, and they probably got a fabulous reaction to fear out of me, because I can tell you now, it was proper fear. I was terrified.
Yeah, I mean, the aspect of this, the biggest challenge, and I think as you referred to and touched on there, Paul, is essentially you are completely alone with dealing with the repercussions of these events. You can't speak to friends. You can't speak to your family. If you, and with the greatest respect, if you try and seek medical support, they'll think you are suffering from mental delusions and you need psychiatric help. You had no avenue of support. So you've had to deal with this from early childhood till you've become an adult and been able to find a support network that both loves and cares for you and also believes you, Paul, which I think's extremely valid. And I think that's one of the striking aspects of the book, especially in your early life, is the way you make it come across of just how alone you must have felt throughout that period, because there was nothing you could do. And as you touched on, You were ready for it, but it didn't matter.
Yeah, you knew at some stage it were going to happen. As a small boy living at Old Denneby, the fear factor, going to bed. I mean, obviously, I've said this before. I'm saying a lot of things that we've spoken about before, but you don't know it's going to happen that night. But because it's been so traumatic when it's happened, you can never settle. You're always waiting.
Yeah.
You're always waiting. And probably 3 months might pass, maybe a year. I don't know. 6 months. But every night you're waiting. Mm. Every night you're on edge, and every night you daren't leave your bed. So you wet the bed. And I don't mean I wet the bed now and again. You know, these are things I could never talk about in my late teens and 20s.
But I
don't know how old I was. But I'm 12 or 13, and I was still terrified to leave that bedroom on a night. And believe me, my dad weren't frightened of giving me a smack. And I used to pray he'd gone to work before I got up on a morning. And it were terrible, but... You see, but all these things that were happening, there were weeks, months in between. Yet that didn't stop. The damage had been done. You've woke up in the night and you've seen these beings and you've felt the pain and experienced the terror of actually seeing them. And that can't be undone. That just can't it's trauma, isn't it? You know, I mean, people experience trauma in other ways in life. People who experience conflict in war zones. You know, my heart goes out to these people because they're probably reliving those moments. I wouldn't say every moment of day or every minute of the day, but I bet you there's not a day goes by without some of the horrific things that people see, they're not going through. People who've suffered abuse at the hands of people, men and women.
Yeah.
It never leaves you. Now, I don't mean this. That is better, because there's no way that I would try and say it is. But the only difference is, like you alluded to earlier, you've got an avenue to get support. With this, there's nowhere. Or there was nowhere when you're a little boy, and even when I were in my 20s and 30s, there's nobody to talk to. There weren't the internet and people to reach out and share experiences. I mean, since the advent of the internet, people are coming forward and people are talking about these experiences. Obviously, you're going to get cranks as well who've done all sorts of weird and crazy things, and who's to say that I'm not viewed exactly the same? You know, I can only be me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not brilliant.
It is, and I think it's one of those interests, because I know there's a point in the book where you refer to having a conversation with Whitley Strieber, I think back in 2015, Paul, and it was that kind of gave you the impetus to finally get this down and get it out more than anything.
Well, no, you know, I was doing spending a lot of time with Steve Ashbridge, a very good friend of mine, on the East Yorkshire Wolds in 2006, 7, 8 and 9. But in 2006, because we were filming these spheres of light that we were seeing over the sea, they were probably being seen over at sea at the same time. But what I'm saying is we were filming them, and I was putting it out on these, I don't know, UFO casebook and all them other things, sending them footage. And Whitley got to see some of this, and he contacted me and asked me if I'd speak on Dreamland. And I said I didn't feel confident enough, but thanked him. I was quite sort of honoured, do you know what I mean? And I thought it was great. And then when I wrote the first book, I thought, and I told him a little bit about my life and things, and, you know, and I wrote the first book and I reconnected and asked if I could speak and talk about the book, and that's when I did. And believe it or not, we didn't talk about the book. We literally, he knew what he wanted to do, and we got straight into what I've now termed the Night People. Back in 2015, what first time I ever spoke about it, and it was a Whitley Strieber, and I'm pleased that I did. I think I said at the time it was like a cork coming off a bottle.
Yeah.
Just to let some of this stuff go. And there's another aspect of it, Paul, and it's not no big deal or anything, but some people live this subject. If I go to bed on a night, I've got these scenarios passing through my mind. So in some way I do, but I do have another life, if you know what I mean. And if we have friends visit, have we got friends, you know, my wife Mary and her friends, and that, and they're not interested in this. So I don't shove it down anybody's throat. I can converse with people about motor cars and holidays and anything they want, because I do realise that some people, all they want to talk about is UFOs and alien abduction and cryptids. And I can talk about that kind of stuff all day and enjoy it. But there is another sort of shade to me, and it's not just UFOs. I can switch off from it, you know, as in a different company, should we say.
I'm exactly the same, Paul. I mean, you know, I think that is the aspect. When people sometimes view us as that's all we ever talk about. It's all we do. It's all we talk about. And I'm one of those people. Yeah, most of my friends aren't into any of this. So, you know, if I go, you know, when we were allowed to go to the pub with friends, you know, we'd talk about football and TV and politics and news and normal stuff or what, you know.
Yeah, so, well...
I'm the same, exactly the same, Paul, I think, and it's difficult sometimes because the other side of me is, yeah, I could talk about cryptids and ufology and the paranormal till the cows come home, and I'd love to talk about it and I enjoy talking about it. But you know, we all have that scenario where we've got two facets to our personalities now, Paul, because we have two sides to us these days.
Well, another part of not wanting to talk about it to certain groups of people is the fact that they won't accept it, and if they're your friends, to hear ridicule from them and stuff, it's almost an insult.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just it's a difficult subject. It's a wonderful subject, and at the same time, it's really difficult. I think it's becoming more accepted. You know, we're in a lot more about it in mainstream. So things are obviously moving, but I don't know if it's going to be fast enough. I mean, some people keep talking about disclosure and it's going to be this date and it's going to be that day. I don't particularly think we're going to have any set time when, I don't know, some person in authority is going to appear on a news broadcast and say we are being visited, because I personally think, Paul, it's already happening. There's just so drip. I mean, children's games, children's toys, everything's aliens. It's almost as though we're being conditioned to accept the fact, and we'll have accepted it, and it'll become the norm. And when it ever does come out that these beings are real, it'll almost be sort of blasé. Well, yeah, I've grown up watching all this stuff, and I'd tell us something new. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit too downplay about it.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those things. I mean, to be honest, if I had a penny for every time somebody said disclosure's coming, I'd have a fair few quid in my pocket, Paul.
Yeah, I get, you know, reports. I wouldn't say loads every day, but I get them pretty often. I mean, I got a good one today, and I spoke to the guy. And I don't know if anybody is familiar with Scarborough at all, but there's some woodland called Raincliffe Woods. And last Tuesday night, this guy, I'll not use his name because I've not got permission to at the moment, but I don't mind talking about what he saw. And he's driving through the woods. You know, we're sort of, there's a road cutting through them. And he sees a huge red sphere of light that size of a basketball. He said it had all tentacles hanging from it, like glowing strands.
Yeah.
Oh, I suppose it could have been some kind of plasma, electricity. I don't know. But he stopped his car and observed this, and then he said it shot into the woods, but was weaving between the trees. Now, that's when he told me the story, I thought brilliant, and I thought, well, is this something what they term as earthlights? But then you've got this weaving between the trees. It's not sort of just blindly just bumping into things or dissipating as it hits a tree. It's weaving between the trees and disappears in Raincliffe Woods, which are just an interesting little sighting, which I'll just make a folder, get as much information as I can, and slot it into it, because that will last Tuesday. I might get a few more reports from around the area within that week, and then it becomes even more interesting. Do you know what I mean? And you've packed a little bit more meat onto the bone to sort of dispel people that are saying, oh, he just imagined it. Oh, well, so well, how do you explain this witness? And how do you explain that witness? That's the way I like to approach these sightings. Find as much information as you can, not just about the actual sighting, but about, just put the word out there, see if anybody else has seen it.
Yeah, it is remarkable, like I say, and often, Paul, especially these days, it's one of those things where as soon as you put something out there, people will tend to come forwards more. As we've mentioned and touched on several times, these days I think people feel a bit more comfortable because we've got things like the internet where people can connect and can share their experiences without the ridicule that used to be hand in hand with anybody that came forward.
That's correct, yeah. It's just a better place to be talking about the subject. As you know, I mean, you don't have to get embroiled in the what I would call as the crazy aspect of it, you know, where, and I'm not going to go into any of details about what I consider crazy, because, you know, I'd end up in some internet war. But, you know, because there'll be people sat there or people listening, and they'll hear what I'm talking about and they'll think that guy's off his head.
Yeah.
Me? You know, and please, I just think to yourself, well, if that's what you think, you know, then fine. I know what I saw, and I know what I experienced, and I'm putting it over best way I can. Hmm. And if it doesn't sit right with you, whoever you may be, I'm not even going to argue with you. I am not going to try and defend myself, because I've no need to.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. What, you don't need to prove it to somebody else. You know it yourself, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things as well is obviously these incidents follow you wherever you move to, Paul, because you move around a couple of times when you're a younger man. And I mean, one of the most striking aspects of this is obviously you're married, you've got your family starting, and you move out to the East Coast and you get that. I mean, I've seen the house in Bridlington. It looks fabulous, beautiful house.
Yeah.
It's the kind of house I'd love to be running around in. But it's almost as if there's this feeling of inevitability about what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
I can feel your frustration that you, it's almost as if you hope that, not that you're trying to avoid anything, Paul, because it didn't seem to matter where you went, they still found you, whatever these things are. I would imagine as the events, because they do seem to taper off a bit into your 20s and 30s, don't they?
That's correct.
I was going to say, it's almost as if you get that sense of relief and think, is it finally over? And
yeah.
And I suppose it's, sadly, it's a false dawn, isn't it?
It is, and that's just what I was going to say. It had been pretty dormant living at Sprotborough. A few things had happened that you wouldn't call abduction alien-related, if that's the word you want to use for it. But then soon as we hadn't even moved in to that property in Bridlington, and it started. You know, it started again, and it's almost as like, we are sounding too crazy, that your life's already mapped out and these things were going to happen. Because, as I said, I was in this property with Sarah, our eldest daughter, when the first thing happened, and we hadn't moved in. I were only going up there to get water services, hot water on, and get this property habitable. And you know, I've said it before, but me and Sarah were laid on this mattress that had been left in the property because we bought it furnished.
Yeah,
unbelievably, you know, the previous owners passed away, and I think the lady had married somebody in late in years and not made a will, and I think the property went to that person's side. So all the valuables, things what people would consider valuable, like photographs and letters and memories, just got left in because they were of no connection to the person who owned the property.
Yeah.
And, you know, we laid there on this mattress, and I woke up at night, and I can remember seeing this dark figure in like an alcove, in like a right angle. There were a door that were painted with wood grain and a 2-foot pillar before it went to the stairs and the balustrade and the spindles, you know, the handrails. That were unusual in itself. I didn't bother getting up. I were looking at it, questioning if I could see it. I can see it. Can you see it? Are you sure you can see? Have a look at Sarah. She's fast asleep. So I know I'm not asleep because I remember looking at her. And this figure looked odd. It looked like it had got a great big hat on, like Peaky Blinders. Is that, you know? But it were just a dark shape. I'm not saying I see any discernible features. But then obviously something had taken, I'd forgot about that, and then I'm looking at the spindles of the staircase and the white. I'm thinking, I haven't painted them white. And I know I haven't. And then light started coming up from below. And this is a staircase that you could look over the top and see the ground floor. It weaved round. It was the main feature of the house. Like 5 metres by about 3.5 metres, maybe 4 metres wide, the old hallway. You could have got an extra 2 bedrooms in property. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If we just put standard staircases in.
Yeah.
And it came up. And whatever it was, this is the only thing in the book, apart from kicking leaves on Church Street. I thought when I started really doing some soul searching and trying to remember things, I would get some kind of download. Things would come back to me because, you know, I were really putting a lot of effort into remembering. But apart from this, nothing else did. Originally, the spindles went white, and then they went shimmered and went, and it were white out, and that were end of it. But I had remembered some more, and it came up, whatever it was. And they were beings. They were, I don't want to call them alien because I'm not sure they're alien to what we are. Let's put it that way.
Mm.
But the first thing I thought, it looked like a nativity scene.
Yeah.
So that's how angelic it must have felt to me viewing it, shimmering beings. It was strange. But I do remember seeing them, and then all of a sudden I'm focusing on the spindles, and they're glowing or shimmering like fluorescent tubes, and then it suddenly just exploded in white light, and the next thing I remembered, it was morning.
Mm.
So that was the first instance before we'd even moved in officially, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And whether these things are planned, whether there's anything else going to happen in the future, I really can't say. There's things happening in the property now.
Mm.
You know, when our girls left, Paul, you know, we're living in this great big house, and me and Mary are thinking we either move or do something with it. Well, me trade as a builder, as a joiner, I've converted it to 3 fully self-contained flats.
Mm.
And I've said it before, and he won't mind me saying it, Bob Brown, who's Beacon of Light radio host,
yep.
he's in the top flat. Now, that's the flat, that's where we viewed the beings, the shimmering, where I viewed the beings, should we say.
Mm.
That's where quite a lot of stuff's happened. I know you're going to touch on somebody in a bit, the Reverend.
Yep.
And Bob's experienced quite a few things these last few weeks. He might be somebody you want to talk to at some point about his own experiences. He told me last week that when he went to bed, he'd not been in bed long, and the bed was going up and down as though a child was jumping on it. To the point where he shouted. But he couldn't get back to sleep then, the rest of the night. He woke up about a month ago. He said there was a sphere of light in the corner of the room like a tennis ball.
Mm.
He's seeing... And he's not been prone to this, listeners. Let me just say that. You know what I mean? It's not something he's just decided he's going to start reporting because I've written Night People.
Yeah.
Bob has been out with me on those cliff tops, bless him, because he does brilliantly. He's in his 70s.
Mm.
For years. And he's never had experiences before, and not in this property, and this is just starting to happen. He's been in now quite a while, and you know he's watching his TV, and a dark shadow or figure, he claims, he's walking through the room. He's seen it 2 or 3 times. I've actually fitted that into Night People. I haven't done the latest ones because obviously the book were finished.
Mm.
So it's still active in some ways. Now, whether that's paranormal, spiritual, ghosts, I don't know what that is, or whether certain places attract all manner of unexplained phenomena. I believe they probably do, because you know, in these areas that we're seeing these light forms, there's also what people have termed a structured UFO scene. Big cats are seen, cryptids are seen. So you know, like I've said in Truth Proof 1, like, location is key, and I think it is. I think certain areas, I don't know what the ingredients are in those areas, but they are able to produce a lot more unexplained phenomena than others. And I think, like when we spoke before, you were on about Sheffield Bypass.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, Stocksbridge Bypass.
The Stocksbridge Bypass. Why does that particular location, let's jump from East Yorkshire for a minute and go to where you live, why does that location throw up unexplained phenomena? What's special about it?
Yeah, exactly, because it's quite unremarkable, you know what I mean? It's a pretty mundane piece of road. It's nothing exciting. The terrain is nothing overly dramatic. It's quite scenic on a sunny day, Paul. It's, you know, yeah. You get nice views out across the valley into Stocksbridge if you're lucky, and you can see for a fair while on a good day. But there's no history of any major disaster there. There's no situations of problems with, you know, the Civil War or pestilence or plague or anything. It's a pretty mundane area.
So I'm sorry if I'm butting in here, Paul, but
no.
And I know we're talking about Night People, but run it past me, kind of things that have been seen there.
Well, the key thing that happened there was that when they started building the bypass, security guards had some encounters with what they termed as shapes, and they could hear singing and noises, and things were being moved around, and then eventually 2 security guards got so scared they ended up going to church for solace and protection, and the police ended up getting called in. The police rather presumed that, you know, during that period people were trying to rob stuff from the building site, Paul, so they assumed that somebody was trying to put the willies up the security guards to to be able to help themselves to some of the stuff up there. And it was the police officer's encounter which probably took it to a different level, because they went up and were attacked, essentially, by whatever was up there. Now, they claimed it was a gentleman in old-fashioned dress. Over the years, people have turned this into a monk. But none of the original encounters were encountering a monk. They were encountering a man in old-fashioned clothing. And the police officers basically had things thrown at their car. It was banged, and then a figure leaned into the car and screamed into one of their faces. And then as one reacted, the other one turned and it was on his side of the car and they got out of there.
It's fascinating, isn't it? You know?
And it's gone from there.
Yeah, and, you know, I suppose other types of phenomena have been reported, but you know, why that area? Have they disturbed something that didn't want disturbing? Is that the same as what happens, you know, the other side of the world on the Indian burial grounds, and why they're getting reports of the skinwalker? You know, is that a guardian of the burial mounds, just like in Egypt, Anubis?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say guardian of the dead. Maybe that was the terminology, but I think he led people to the afterlife, didn't he? These dog deities. But, you know, we've jumped a few paces there, Pete. Sorry about that. But,
well, it is interesting, because I spoke to Steve Jones, who's a druid, Paul. And Steve does a lot of investigation into hooded entities that hang around earthworks in the UK.
Okay.
And a lot of the time he gets reports where things have been disturbed. So it may have been something like that. I mean, Sheffield does have a history that goes back, you know, well over 1500 years. You know, it's been a main city and large town for a considerable period of time. So there is a long history of people living in the area from all kinds of cultures, and obviously even, you know, going back to the Roman times. So, though we don't have too many settlements, the Romans did come through here. And obviously it's been an area that's not particularly known for being overly paranormal, to be fair, Sheffield, though it has had several weird encounters. We've had UFO flaps over the years. We've obviously got Stocksbridge. We've got a couple of notable properties in the city centre that are known for being haunted. And then obviously we're surrounded by the Peak District, which is full of tales of myth and legend as well, Paul. So it is a... If you don't look for it, you'll not find it. But if you bother to sort of cast your eye a little bit further, you will find a variety of strange and wonderful things around the area.
That's correct. It's amazing, isn't it? When you do start looking, the amount of information that you start unearthing, and, you know, and people who you never thought would have a story to tell as well. That never ceases to amaze me. But, yeah, fire away, Paul, because I've sidetracked you.
Hey, that's... I'll tell you something. The one name I did not expect to turn up in your book was the Reverend Tom Willis. Now, so let me try and paraphrase what happened. So you were at home, no pre-arranged meeting or anything, and the Reverend Willis seems to have taken upon himself to just come in and bless your property. Is that right?
That's correct. He just arrived. We'd all moved in. We'd probably only been in a few days. If I shouted Mary, she might say we'd been in a week. I don't know, but not been in long. So it's four little girls. I think Sarah were eldest. She'd have been 10 or 11, maybe. I don't know. No, maybe not even that. But there's a knock at the door. So I go to the front door, girls in tow. I mean, they're all excited. They've just moved into a new home. And it's the Reverend Willis. And he said, you know, explained who he was and that he'd like to come and bless the property. And I let him in. We stood in the hallway, a bit bemused, really. You know, and I'd not got this, what had happened upstairs, on my mind in any way to connect with this reverend that had just appeared. And he said he'd done it before in the past. We'll get back to him in a minute. While we were clearing the property, we had a fire going constantly, day and night. Not during the night, but, you know, there were tons, as I said, there's other people's possessions in here, old sofas and everything. You wouldn't be able to burn these things now, people. I do realise that, but we did. And a large back garden. But I was burning bags and bags of letters. And I must have burnt, like, oh, God, 10, 20 bags before we even realised what they were. And they were spirit letters. And I think we've kept a few of them. And I'm saying think because I don't know where they are.
Mm.
And the people that had lived there previously had been, they'd been dabbling in something. Mm. They'd be whether it were the occult or whether they were just spiritualists. But you know, one letter, one page could have three or four different types of handwriting and three or four different people, or the same person writing but writing about different things. It were weird. And as I say, we were burning them, so maybe that's why he'd been to bless the property in the past.
Mm.
So he came in and he said he'd like to bless the property, and I was compliant. I said, yeah, okay, then, sort of thing. And I followed him upstairs, and he's sort of going round the landings, and he gets to the top of the house, and he said, opened the door, there's a bed in it already and what have you, and he says, I wouldn't let your children stay in this room. Before I had chance, really, I looked round and Sarah's behind us, and she's got a look on her face like she's terrified. And I'm not blaming Reverend Willis. I'm partly to blame for that. He should have actually looked as well before he opened his mouth, but yeah. I should have checked that Sarah wasn't there. So to cut a long story short, I said, look, I said, she's frightened to death. You've just said that. That's her bedroom. And... you know, I says, I think it'd be best if you left. So he did. I wish I'd have spent more time talking to him, Paul.
Mm.
Well, I wish now, I mean, I think he passed away in probably 2009. I'm not certain.
2014 he died.
2014 shows what I know, doesn't it? And I probably put up people, so I might be getting a bit of memory loss. You never know. was it that he stopped working as an exorcist?
Yeah, he was knocking on. I mean, I think he was... I think he was in his 80s when he passed away, in his mid to late 80s.
Stopped working in 2009 then, because he'd probably gone on after retirement.
Yeah.
And he were known for a time as Britain's official exorcist, weren't he?
Yes.
For the Catholic Church, I think that's correct. And they made TV documentaries about him and everything, because I knew none of this when he arrived.
Mm. Mm.
And as I say, I just asked him to leave in end, but he is somebody I would like to research and write about, I must admit.
Yeah,
Because somewhere there will be a detailed log of his exploits, I would think, somewhere.
Yeah, he's one of those characters. I kind of stumbled across him in the mid-90s, primarily, Paul, because there is an infamous paranormal case, primarily because it was about a fishing trawler.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Called the Pickering.
That's correct.
And this boat was apparently haunted, and the crew essentially were sick to death of this boat. They were sick to death of going out to sea on it, because things would just break down. They'd fill it up with fuel, the pumps wouldn't work, the engine would break, the radio would stop working, and essentially they all had to keep signing on because they simply couldn't go out to sea to fish.
Yeah.
And it was, I believe, it was actually the guy at the job centre who said, you need to get it exercised. And whether he contacted the Reverend Willis on their behalf or somebody put them in touch with him, Willis turned up and exercised the boat.
Yeah. And did it settle it?
It did. It finished it off. Though, strangely enough, the boat sank the following year and was lost at sea.
I'm 99% certain, because I have spoke about this. I've got a contact who was a trawlerman called Tom Quinn, and I'll have written about Tom in connection with the tornado that crashed in December 1985.
Yeah.
But what I've probably never said is Tom's got a twin called David, Dave.
Mm.
And Dave told me all about it, because Dave was actually on the boat, the Pickering.
Wow.
Yeah, I forgot about it. I've never written about it, and I'm pretty sure. I mean, I haven't got it in great detail. They gave me a book. I've got the book somewhere. Somebody had wrote about it, pretty tatty, but I think it was Dave or Tom that gave it me. But all Dave commented on was the fact that the boat was never warm. Obviously, these are seasoned trawlermen. They're not somebody who's been sat on Yorkshire Bell and gone out to sea for half an hour.
Yes.
You could never get it warm. He said all sorts of strange, fluky things happened on the boat. I think he said that they could hear talking. I mean, it weren't a massive boat, you know, and the all sorts of unexplained paranormal things did happen on the boat. And I do remember him telling me that, but I didn't know Reverend Willis was the man that exercised the said spirit or demons or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, yeah, he was quite, in my experience and what I know about him, he was one of those people who tended to see the occult wherever it may not be, Paul, shall we say.
Yeah.
And he had a very dim view on quite a lot of modern things, shall we say. So I think there was a lot of self-promotion in there, because he, I'm trying to think, one of the first interviews I ever saw him talking about exorcisms and black magic and the occult was back in 1971. So he'd been at it a fair while, you know what I mean? So he'd gone everywhere, and I think the last time I saw him mentioned in a paranormal sense, there was a poltergeist in Hull.
Yeah.
And he came out to the house and exorcised whatever was in there and helped the family through that. And I think that was about 2003.
Well, like you say, we're still working then in 2003. Mm. So when I said 2009, I think, because I have written about him, I think that's when he packed in.
Mm.
So, yeah, interesting, isn't it? You know, why would he come?
Yeah.
You know, we'd never asked him to come. He did say that somebody had told him that new people had moved into the property, and that's why he wanted to do it. I mean, and he weren't wrong, you know. He weren't wrong about that room.
Yeah.
It's the people over the road. I mean, I got on really well with this guy over the road, probably the only person he ever bothered with, but he told me that, because he had a lung condition, he'd worked in a foundry, and he struggled with breathing, and he couldn't sleep comfortably laid down. So he used to sit in an armchair in his front room and just with lights off and just try and get sleep, ironically smoking. that were him. I'll not say his name, but that were him. And he were a good bloke. I've not but fond memories of him. But he'd tell me, he said, you know, early hours at morning, I'm looking across at your house, he says, and I've seen a red light appearing up in ceiling, up in top, because, you know, the curtains would be open, nobody to look in, really. Just a red ball of light, like a tennis ball, he said, and I see another one. And then they're turning, and then they're moving about in room, and I'm thinking, is it kids acting about? He says, and then I see them drop into another room through floors. And these things had happened with a white sphere of light, and he told me these things. Ironically, I didn't get all of this information out of him until he was really ill, in latter stages of his illness. He told me some things, but it were in latter stages of his illness that I were getting these bits of information out of him. But interesting, nevertheless, that he'd observed these strange things. I mean, I don't know, he's probably got more to tell, but he was so hard-faced and non-compliant kind of guy. That's the reason he didn't bother with many people. So I was probably lucky to get what I got out of him, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, but it's not just these little things as well, and like you mentioned about Bob. I know one of your other tenants, there seems, when you look at it, if you take the Bridlington property out of your story and look at it separately, Paul.
Yeah.
To most people, if they look at that, they'll say it's haunted.
I would agree. I totally agree. And Don Lodge, who helped me with the book, with everything, you know, as in he sort of straightened all my bad spelling and punctuation out, and you know, an enormous help. But he picked up on what you've just said, and he said, you know, it's almost as though there were two things running alongside of each other here.
Yeah.
But if you've heard me, and I know we have spoke before, and if you hear me talk about these things, I do think that it's all connected anyway. And, you know, it's almost like when a big paranormal event happens, be it UFO-related or be it cryptid, ghost, whatever you want to call it, it's almost like somebody's thrown a huge rock into a pool and all these ripples come out and everything else is stirred up, the paranormal soup, everything else is sort of excited in the mix, and you'll find lots and lots of other unexplained phenomena occurring around the same time. And I think part of the problem, or part of the the disguise is that you've got your paranormal investigator, you've got your ghost investigator, you've got your UFO man, and never the 2, 3, 4 will mix, which to me is crazy. They're all missing a trick because there is a connection between everything that's happening. I don't know what I don't profess to know what the connection is, by the way, but I do think there's a connection.
Well, I think, and I know I've spoken to a couple of people, Paul, who work on that principle that one Fortean aspect is very similar to the other, and you will often find different types of phenomenon going on in the same area or in around the same locality. So I've come across situations where people have had UFO flaps or UFO sightings or even cryptid sightings, and then they have also had occurrences of haunting or poltergeist activity in their property.
Yeah. Well, you know, the perfect case for me, at least, for that is Hunnamby. You know, because the industrial estate, we haven't got time to talk about that in any detail tonight, but them three guys that worked on that industrial estate in between 1967 and 1998 experienced every type of phenomena, from poltergeist related phenomena to UFOs to cryptids to a full blown UFO landed craft. All three of them were talking about now how the poltergeist activity fits in with it, or whether the excitement of what was happening, somehow the ingredients were all there to ignite the other stuff. I really don't know. They were, you know, do they call it apport when things appear, and you know, all sorts of things, coins dropping from the air, gravel dropping from the air, lights suddenly going bright in the workshop and bulbs exploding. But at the same time, you think, oh, that could be just a power surge, but the radio, which is plugged into the socket, carries on playing, yet all the power's off in the building. How does that work? Do you know, it's incredible. Hunnamby, to me, is probably the best thing I've ever looked into, and I'm at a bit of a brick wall at the moment, because eventually somebody else will come forward, but you know, I'm at a bit of a standstill with it at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough, because obviously when I saw you at the Outer Limits conference last year, that was the case you talked about, Paul, and it was.
I was really disappointed though, you know, because the actual images and the interviews, the witness interviews, wouldn't play. And that threw me. I'm no disrespect to guys at Outer Limits. All three conferences have gone down really well. But, that did throw me a little bit. I were a little bit upset about that for weeks. But, yeah, fire away, Paul. Sorry.
No, that's all right. I was just going to say, and it's one of those things, because, you know, as soon as most people who listen to this show know, as soon as the word poltergeist is mentioned, my ears prick up. Because it is probably my favourite aspect of the weird. And I just found it a very compelling case, because, once again, you've got three salt of the earth lads working together, not prone to flights of fancy, who just end up being caught smack bang in the middle of just a variety of weird situations that they can't get their heads around.
Spot on. And let's not forget, Paul, that they'd sat on this, all three of them, since 1998. And this, it would have remained dormant if not for a good friend of mine, ex-military guy, Jim, who oversees finances at a working men's club in Flamborough, which Andrew happened to be doing decorating on, and you know, with his son, and Andrew's son David used to work with me. Me and David worked together for years, and he always knew my interest but never told me about his dad's experience. How strange. Because they wanted it to remain silent, but he made the mistake of telling Jim. The subject of unexplained came up one day, nothing to do with me, whilst they were working, and he made the mistake of telling Jim. And the first thing, after Jim had listened to it, he says, you must tell Paul Sinclair. And he couldn't get away with it then. And I mean that with full respect to Andrew, because he lives literally 200 yards from me. And I've known him years, and he'd never told me. But once I found out, I contacted David. David had a word with his dad, and his dad agreed to speak to me. And I sat across his kitchen table and with a voice recorder, and recorded his story several times. And from there, we got in touch with other witness. And from there, the other witness got in touch with the number three, because Andrew had not spoken to a guy he used to work for in many, many years. And guess what? They were all singing from same in sheet. They were all saying same story. why did they close up? Why did they shut down? Because what they were telling people, everybody just laughed at them.
Yeah.
And they just, in the end, they just thought, this is not worth talking about. We are just not going to talk about this. And that's the way of things.
I mean, it is one of those things. And like I said, I've heard other researchers who prescribe to the idea, Paul, that once you pull the curtain back on one particular part of the paranormal, whatever it is, it tends to make it easier for everything else to come through.
I would agree. And it might not, I don't know what it is that makes it easier. It might just be, it might be an ingredient, Paul, within the people, within us.
Yeah.
Once we believe it's possible, seeing is believing, once you've seen it, you know it's possible, you're going to see more.
Mm.
Because there's not the restrictions within you have been lowered, you know, and you're more receptive to the idea that this is real and this can happen. And I think it could be as simple as that. Maybe I haven't got the words to describe what I'm trying to say there, but I think you maybe know what I mean.
I do. I mean, it's one of those things, Paul, like we've spoken to before when I saw my ball of fire, right?
Yeah.
Nobody can tell me what I didn't see, you know? And as we touched on earlier on, I've had people say, oh, well, you saw a Chinese lantern. I watched it for 40 minutes. I know it wasn't a Chinese lantern, and it didn't act like a Chinese lantern, and it didn't look like a Chinese lantern. And where I live in Sheffield, I see a lot of Chinese lanterns.
Yeah, and there lies the frustration, because you've got principal witness who's not stupid, who's observed quite a lot of unexplained phenomena, be it on video or listened to witness accounts, but you've got people who haven't been sat there, who weren't stood with you at the time, but they know better.
Mm.
And that's the part I find frustrating. You know, the guy who sits behind the screen of the laptop or the computer and types in comments about what he knows what you've seen. I never get involved. I don't engage. But I do find it annoying that, we've got these critics who know much more than the person who's actually seen it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to be a field researcher when you sit behind a desk.
It is. Well, there's not many people doing it, is there? Nobody wants to. You know, Monday night, I was in the forest all night with Les Drake and Witness, gathering stories for Dark Forest Project, in deep in a forest, you know, and just sat there amongst the pine trees getting these stories, not expecting to see what these guys have claimed to have seen, but getting the accounts. And you know what? Lockdown restrictions might hold us back from it, but we'll be doing it again if lockdown permitting. Do you know what I mean? Very soon. And we want to gather as much as we can. For Dark Forest, we've probably got 7 witnesses.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I'm really buoyed up about this project.
Absolutely. But, yeah. So, in general then, Paul, what is Dark Forest about, and what's drawn you to this area? What makes this area seem special?
Well, on February 7th, 2019, I was contacted by the former paratrooper who claimed he'd seen, in his words, a werewolf on the clifftops at Bempton. Since then, I think it was January 31st this year, a lady called Jamie and her friend visited Flamborough. No prior knowledge of the cryptids or anything. Contacted me. They were only on for a weekend. Claimed they'd seen something resembling a werewolf. So you can see where Dark Forest's going, because I've been contacted by other people that have claiming to have seen something very similar. We're not talking about silver bullets and full moons here, people, although me and Bob Brown spoke to a guy this year who claimed that on the full moon of November the 12th, but he didn't come out with them dates, but I knew when he said it were November and it were a full moon.
Yeah.
I did that bit of research. November the 12th, 2019, what did he claim he's seen on the clifftops? A werewolf. How incredible. Now, I was contacted last week, believe it or not, and it was October the 12th, and I've got him on film, so it would come back to bite me on the backside if I were lying. And we've got the dates, and he's going to be included in Dark Forest. What does he claim to have seen? A werewolf. Bempton. Unbelievable. You're the first person I've told about it, and I suppose now whoever's listening. So I'm not subscribing to the idea that everybody who claims to have seen one of these things has to be telling the truth. But I will always stand by the fact that we've got multiple witnesses within a 30-mile radius all claiming to have seen something very similar with nothing to gain, and they don't know each other.
Yeah.
There's got to be some truth attached to some of this.
I mean, it is as well. And the striking thing about this, Paul, is I know the UK has a history of what most people know as shooks, black shooks, giant black dogs up and down the country. And obviously in Yorkshire, we call them bargasts because we like to be awkward.
Well, no, let me just, I don't mean correct you there.
Yeah.
Right. 7 miles from the forests of eastern North Yorkshire. Well, less. I was 7 miles from the principal witness part of the forest, but 5 miles away is East Ayton. Mm. And I've found in an archive in Bridlington someone writing over 100 years ago about the Barguest of East Ayton.
Ah.
Yeah, and I've you know, I've printed the paper off. I've got it, and you know, I know which paper I found it in, but it's in the paper about 1840.
Wow.
And he's done a, I wouldn't say a detailed study of it. He's written an article that's about a page and a half long.
Mm.
Describing the Barguest of East Ayton, which is 6 miles from where these people are claiming to have seen these things. You know, because anybody who... The Barguest, huge black dog.
Yeah.
huge, fearsome canine, sort of far bigger than what it should be, and with the ability to walk on two legs at times. So quite interesting. And then you've got the Padfoot, you've got the black shook, like you said.
Yeah.
You know, and up and down at Ravenscar, at Whitby. And you know... all up and down the eastern North Yorkshire coast, but let's not just claim it for us. Mm. Like you just said, these sightings of these creatures are in your neck of woods as well, aren't they?
Yeah. There's a few tales of bargasts up and down South Yorkshire, and I've been for centuries, Paul, and I've just finished reading one of Ruth Roper Wild's book about British ghosts, and there's several notable stories in there regarding people seeing black shooks and giant dogs in Norfolk, in the Midlands, Scotland. So it's something that's been with us for centuries.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's, and you know, I don't know. I mean, there's for these bits of folklore to have sort of stood the test of time and come through, and then in modern day sort of literature. I mean, am I writing folklore? Because I've got people telling me similar stories. Or is there some truth attached to it? Just because, you know, academia can't get their head around that there could be some reality to these things does not mean it's not happening.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing as well is East Yorkshire is one of those areas that has a couple of well-established legends in regards to werewolves, Paul, doesn't it?
I think probably one of the oldest werewolf accounts in the world is the one that I've written about probably more than anybody in the world, and that's the Flixton Werewolf.
Yep.
And I know there's the Beast of Barmston Drain, you know, in Hull.
Yeah.
But and I don't mean that's not a credible, good story, but what they've not done with the Beast of Barmston Drain is tell everybody that quite a few of the accounts that they've included when writing about the Beast of Barmston Drain are actually from Flixton.
Mm. Mm.
You know, the talk of it attacking a timber wagon in the 1970s is Flixton.
Yeah.
On the A1039 in Flixton, yet they've moved it 45 miles, or conveniently not told people that it's actually the Flixton story. Do you know, and it's not been the Flixton story in recent times, it's been the Flixton story since the 1970s.
Yeah. Is that the one they call Old Stinker?
Yes.
Yeah. Because that was supposed to have been... Because I remember seeing something about that a couple of years ago, that a couple were out... And they saw it because it's seen in a sort of like a river area, isn't it? That one.
Yeah, the Barmston Drain. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the area of sort of drainage. It's man-made drainage.
Yes.
Somebody will correct me here, but in the 1800s, I think they dug it to drain, you know, low-lying parts of Humberside.
Yeah.
It's interestingly, the Barmston Drain runs out into the sea, so it's not a drain for sewerage, it's just low-lying land water, but it comes out into the sea just 6 miles from where I'm sat at Bridlington. So if if there was some truth to this story, if you went another 3 miles up the coast, you'd end up at Danes Dyke, where there's reports of this thing. If you went a little bit further up, you'd end up at Whitby, where there's reports of this thing, and Ravenscar and Kettleness. Probably Kettleness is the one that's got the most stories that I've ever come across of the huge black dogs, little nondescript fishing town that nobody will have ever heard of.
Yeah.
Do you know? But it's there. But what then you need not need to look at, but should look at, is if you were around Scarborough, Whitby, Ravenscar, and then you wanted to jump inland 3 miles, you'll be on the edge of the North Yorkshire Moors National Park. You'll be in the forests where these things are being reported.
Yeah.
You know, once again, location is key.
It is. And I mean, it's one of those areas as well, because strangely enough, when we were talking at the beginning of August, Paul, and I was on my way up through there, and you mentioned it. And the thing that surprised me about the North Yorkshire is once you get past Wetherby, that's it. There's nothing there. It's farmland and little villages here and there.
Yeah.
And woodlands everywhere. There is very little large civilization until you come up to Durham. You know what I mean? You pass Middlesbrough and then that's it. There's nothing from Wetherby to Middlesbrough. So you're talking like 40 miles.
Yeah, well, what you're talking about, as in square miles for the North Yorkshire Moors National Park, I don't know the exact amount. I think it's 524 square miles. Now, I'm not saying that there's living, breathing bipeds that have evaded detection throughout man's documented history, because I'm not in a position to say that. But what I am saying is that these biped creatures have been reported throughout that time.
Mm.
Or be biped or on four legs. I mean, you jump to Goathland around, you know, and they've got the legend of what's called the Guy Trash, a huge spectral hound.
Yep.
You know, and I think that the Guy Trash, I think, the writer, Jane Eyre, is it Austin?
Yes.
Lots of people. You know, then the black dog in Bram Stoker's Dracula. They say that Bram Stoker sort of used the black hounds that are reported around Whitby and Scarborough, because obviously Dracula, I think he wrote it whilst living in Whitby, didn't he? And
that's how Dracula comes ashore, as a giant black dog.
Yeah, and that was inspired by the Black Shuck, which has been reported long, long before the story of Dracula.
Mm.
You know, so it is interesting in itself, isn't it? You know, all these legends and all these myths are still repeating themselves in present day when you've got paratroopers saying that they've seen these things. Mm. You know, and when this guy, I mean, I've 100% faith in Rob. I really have. He's a credible witness. And when he's saying to me, like, I've done Bogside in Northern Ireland, I've done Iraq.
Yeah.
But when I saw that thing, the fear level was on a different level to anything I've ever seen before. And, you know, and it's a theme that repeats itself with all of these witnesses, barring one. And I've got 100% faith in the one. And listeners, I have had other people report these things, and I've not done anything with the stories. I've not been disrespectful to the people, but I've not done anything with them. You know, I've heard the story two or three times, and it's changed two or three times. And that tells me that, you know, they might not have seen quite what they're telling me they've seen. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite funny as well, because whilst I was holidaying there, we went up to a place called High Force, which is a fabulous waterfall, Paul. High Force, it's called, which
not
is in the
Falling Force.
And essentially, it's the River Tees comes over this beautiful waterfall. It's absolutely stunning. Incredible.
Right.
And so we came out of the car. We'd been up to see it because my partner, it's one of her favourite places to visit in the UK. She loves it. And I'd never been before. And it is jaw-dropping. It's wonderful. So as we came out of the car park, we should have turned left. And if we'd have turned left, it had taken us 30 minutes to get to the next hotel, because we were having like a little drive round and just stopping at a couple of places. But for some reason, the sat-nav took us right. And we ended up driving through the North Yorkshire Moors for 2 hours. Middle of the day, and ironically, before we've even had this conversation, it's what's, I'm smiling to myself, because as we were driving through the North Yorkshire moors, I'm looking around and it's just sheep and the occasional odd farmhouse here and there, Paul.
Yeah, it's vast. I mean, a lot of it isn't forest, I realise that.
Yeah.
But there are deep forests within the North Yorkshire Moors National Park.
Yeah, yeah, big time.
Fabulous. I'll tell you what surprised me in one of the forests we slept in for several nights with witnesses. I've never been in anywhere as dark in my life.
Mm.
Darker than forest I were in other night, and there were no stars. It was quite overcast, but good God, this place were dark. And yeah, interesting, really interesting. You know, you get to meet some interesting people and visit some incredible locations. I mean, if you like the edginess of these situations, which I do, you know, you sort of crave more of it. I like being in those kind of places. I bought a thermal camera. And before going into this particular forest on Monday night, Saturday, I contacted one of the farmers that I know, and there's a woodland at the back of his place, and I said, can I come up and park at farm and go into Woodwick Thermal?
Mm.
And I don't mean, oh, I were brave. My head were on a swivel because I took a torch in but didn't use it. I just wanted to use the thermal.
Yeah.
And saw nothing unusual, but I wanted to test it and just to get best out of it for when we went into the forest. But that's the kind of thing I crave. I really enjoy that kind of situation, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody said to me now, well, we're up on cliff tops, but we're at Speaton, Paul. Can you get up here? There's things happening. I'd have probably a 2 mile walk to get to them, but I'd park up and I'd go.
Mm.
It wouldn't bother me. You know, that's the way it is.
Absolutely, and I think you've just got to go when you can, because, you know, these opportunities don't present themselves all the time. Like, you know, like we've spoke before, Paul, and I've heard you interview before on other shows, and often a criticism is, oh, well, why don't you, this seems to be happening all the time. But it's not, is it?
It's, and it's not happening all the time. You know, there's three books about, and they're full of reports and encounters in eastern North Yorkshire. Number three is spread out a bit from eastern North Yorkshire. But what I need to stress to people is, there's reports and encounters that go back decades and decades. So although the potential to see or experience something strange is there, with an high probability or a higher probability than a place that just, well, simply doesn't have that kind of activity, don't expect to go there and see something, because, for instance, me and Bob Brown have probably gone now for months and months, and we'd go quite regular and nothing. Absolutely nothing. Yet I got a report on the 12th, as I've just said, last week, and a guy claims to have seen a cryptid. I'm going to speak to him later tonight. I've already spoke to him, by the way, and I've already filmed him, but I'm going to speak to him later tonight. We were on phone earlier and I said I'd ring you. I think he's watching there must be some football on. I don't know what it is, but he's watching that, and I think we've done it, and I'm going to speak to him.
Yeah, Champions League tonight, Paul.
Is that what it, well, you can, I'm sorry, guys. That's if it were boxing or rugby, I really enjoy, but I'm not a football fan. But I realise I'm outnumbered here by the many, because there's plenty of football fans, and I'm not knocking it.
We'll let you off. So, Paul, before I let you go, my friend, I know you've touched on the first three True Proof books, and the last time I heard you speak, you were working your way through number four. So yeah. What's happening with Truth Proof 4, and what can we expect from that, my friend?
True Proof 4, there's enough content already to put one together, but I'll need to be just getting well into these. I've put everything into a folder, and I know there's probably 80,000 to 90,000 words, but I'll have to run it past Don Lodge and let him sort of, like I've said before, I've no shame in saying it, help me with my punctuation and tell me that, you know, you've repeated yourself there. Not, I don't mean word for word, but you've probably, I might, it's a shame, because I might have spent all afternoon writing something, and he said, you've just about told us same thing 3 pages ago. Do you know what I mean? So you have to admit it. But they stare in your face, these things, and you don't see them, and you need somebody who's honest and fair to point these things out to you. I mean, and I also need to say, but, you know, the first three books, I had some fabulous help with Carl Jackson Barnes. I really did, you know. Just Carl's gone his own way and doing his own thing, and full credit to Carl. But I'm equally thankful for Don. So I get a lot of help. You know, the actual content, the actual writing, nobody's doing it but me. So please don't think somebody's ghostwriting for me, because they're not. But I get a lot of help. I mean, me and computers, me and things that are technical, I'm pretty useless. I'm all right at knocking things in with an hammer. That's my job as a joiner. But, you know, yeah, so I'm thankful. I get a lot of help. And let's face it, Paul, these books would be nothing without these fabulous people that are brave enough to come through with their stories and have faith in me that I'm going to put their story over. I don't mean in a believable light. I can only tell people what they've seen. I'm not going to massage it, but I just want to put them over in the best light possible, and that's all what it's about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll look forward to it regardless, Paul. Cause,
yeah, Trump-proof 4, yeah. I know I've jumped again, didn't I? But, yeah, I'm well on with that. There's plenty of content for that, but there's also content for... I want to write a fabulous book on the cryptid, on the werewolf, really, if you want to call it werewolf.
Yeah.
And I've got a lot of information that's already written up. I've already spent days and weeks on it, so I don't know when it's coming, but I'm definitely going to be doing that.
Yeah, well, I think, as we've touched on there, we've got such a rich history of this Bargast, Shook, Padfoot, whatever you want to call them, all over the UK. And obviously this area of Yorkshire as well, some of the areas have very strange names that hark back to strange things that could be there, don't they?
But they really do, yeah. You know, I mean, just like we said, along the edge of the eastern North Yorkshire coast, you know, up towards Whitby, you've got Hundale Point, and you think, well, what does that mean? It actually means Houndale Point. So I don't mean, oh, that's the reason that we've got these dogs, but a little bit further up, you've got Beast Cliff. And there's been reports. I've got reports from rock anglers of seeing this upright canine. Where? Beast Cliff. It's crazy. Do you know, so... I mean, the rock anglers have got nothing to gain. They don't come looking for me, by the way. You know, I drop on these people because at the end of October, after all the seabirds have left the nesting grounds of eastern North Yorkshire along the cliffs, the guys are allowed to fish the cliff tops. And that's obviously they fish the tide, you know, the incoming tide and the outgoing tide. And they see a lot of things. There's nobody better placed than them guys when they're sat there probably for sometimes between 4 and 7 hours just observing out at sea. And that's when I get my best reports. That's when I'll get somebody who'll ring me up in early hours at morning and say, you know, if you could get yourself up here now, it's really active. These lights are showing up. And I'll say, is there any aircraft? No, we've just got a string of lights just appeared in the sky, switched off, and then there's another one further down coast, you know, unless it's the same one. And it's brilliant. You know, it's good to have this little network of eyes that aren't really interested in the subject, to be honest with you, Paul, but they, by the same token, they know there's something there. What I find interesting as well, you do get different opinions on what they are from the rock anglers. And the movements of these objects, I know we've touched on them earlier, so I don't want to bore people, but they're not flares. But you'll get some saying, oh, it's just flares. You'll get others saying it's meteor. So I'm just thinking, oh, right, yeah, so you're going to get 4 or 5 meteors just suddenly switch on in a string, in a line, bright gold, look like Jaffa cakes in the sky.
Yep.
It's a good word description for a minute. But, yeah. And then just switch off and, oh, it's meteors. Or it's afterburners. Did you hear any aircraft? Well, no. You know, there's something different. They really are. It's something different. But whether we'll ever get to the bottom of what they actually are, I don't know.
Well, I'm interested to try and find out where we go with this all next, Paul, because it's always fascinating to speak with you, and I'm always interested to see whatever you've released, and I love reading your work. So,
thank you, Paul. I don't think we touched on night people, really, did we?
Well, I think we touched on it as much as we could, my friend, and it was enjoyable to get into there. So, listen, it's always a pleasure. Good luck with the interview with the witness later on, and you stay safe in those woods, my friend. Take care.
Thank you very much. Take care.